Ah, I still did not update the battery in my mouse. I'm still at 10%. I can make it through this lecture. We're good. All right. Good afternoon. It is Thursday afternoon. It is April 8th, 12:40, and we're on our second lecture of mass spec. And so what I want to do today, let me go ahead and start a screen share. And we have a lot to do yet on mass spec. Admittedly, mass spec goes a lot faster than NMR because there's a lot less to mass spec than there is to NMR. With NMR, there's a lot of differences in the coupling constants and what you're looking for and how to put the molecule together. With mass spec, we're not trying to reconstruct a molecule. In mass spec, really, the goals are to try to get some of the fragmentations to give you some ideas about functional groups, but mainly to get the mass. That is the whole idea behind mass spec. So understanding how to get the mass from mass spec is the main component of what we do. But understanding some of the fragmentations and other things can be helpful too. So I think that what I want to do, I'm reformulating my plan as I'm sitting here and explaining it, going from the priorities of what we can get from mass spec. Maybe what I want to do is reassess the way in which I had planned to go through the material and reformat that based on my priorities. Okay, so mass spectrometry. You guys see the screen okay? Everything's good? Okay. Check before I start. With mass spectrometry, these are our priorities. Number one, we want to find the molecular ion peak, get the mass to charge ratio, and the molecular formula. That is the whole goal right there, is to get the molecular formula. Beyond that, or I should say the tools for that are identifying the molecular ion peak use the rule of 13. And also use the C13 isotope ratio to help identify number of carbons. Beyond that, the other thing that we use is we use isotope effects. To identify bromine, which gives a 50-50 relative abundance in the molecular ion peak, chlorine, which gives a 75-25 relative abundance in the molecular ion peak, where these are two atomic mass units apart for the peak. So what we're looking at is we're looking at two peaks that are sort of 50-50, where these are 2 units apart. If we call this the molecular ion, then this guy over here is the molecular ion plus two, because they're always 2 units apart. Bromine is 35, excuse me, chlorine is 35 and 37. Bromine is 79 and 81, 2 units apart. So we're always looking 2 units apart at those things. And chlorine, like I said, is 25, 75 in terms of its ratios. Those are really the two big isotope effects. Because the other halogens don't have isotope effects, and other elements, we typically don't look for other isotope effects with other elements. So those are the main two isotope effects that we look at. And then from there, the last thing is fragmentations. Where the fragmentations can help identify functional groups. Some of the fragmentations can help us tell whether or not there's a carboxylic acid or an aldehyde or an alcohol or other things. And besides that, the fragmentations can also give us subunits for the molecule. They can help us ID a molecule from possible candidates. And so with this, really what we're looking at is trying to get the mass. That is the most important thing. These isotope effects, because they play into the mass, into the molecular formula. And the fragments are really secondary to everything else. And so let's take that molecular formula idea and let's look at the molecular formula idea in a little bit more detail. Let me not do this in the notes. Let me try to switch applications for you and to be able to show you something that illustrates a point. I want to go to IMAS. And I have an IMAS calculator up. I'm going to stop the screen share and share my IMAS calculator. Okay, so what this calculator does, which is kind of nice, is I can take and put in CH4. And instead of showing me a summary, I can ask it to show me the isotope distribution. Now, this would be considered to be the molecular ion peak that we're looking at. And what I can do with the molecular ion peak is I can increase intensities so that I can scale this up and see what's sitting in the baseline. I think that I can broaden this out so that I can more closely look at values that are next to each other. But what it's showing me is that one or that 16.03 and 16.04, those values there are the molecular ion peak. And you can see that it's giving me, as I move the cursor, it's giving me an MZ ratio and telling me what the MZ ratio is where the cursor is. And it's also telling me the percent. So if I come up here, I can sit on 16.06 at 100% and see what that is. Now, let me put a bromine into this molecule and see what the isotope effect is. So that means I need to take away a hydrogen and I need to put in a bromine. That changes its mass, but what it's also going to show me is it's going to show me here, now it's showing me the 94 with a big line, and I wish it didn't have these deep lines because the deep lines sort of obscure the peaks that are happening here. But I have a 93.94, and I have over here a 96. And if I get to it, it's right on close to 90. 96, this one is right on close to 94. So we'll round it out. We'll say 94 and 96. What these are is this is the molecular ion peak with a bromine, which is 79. And this is a molecular ion peak with a bromine, which is 81. And you can see how their relative intensities are very much, very close to being equal because bromine 79 and bromine 81 are just about equal in their percentages. If I change this from bromine to a chlorine, the mass changes, but watch what happens to the isotopes. I get that characteristic 3:1 isotope ratio, where this is roughly 50 and this is 52. 2 units apart, again, because the isotope is 2 units apart, if that makes sense. But what you're seeing in addition to these is, let me blow the baseline up a little bit. See these little peaks down here? What are these little guys? So the question is, what are these guys? Let me switch to a different type of series now. Let me go back to CH4. CH4 that has no halogens. With no halogens, CH4 demonstrates one molecular isotope peak. And it has this little tiny bump that's sitting down here that is just 1 unit away. That 1 unit away, this is 16. This one little unit away is 17. Watch what happens to this bump as I change from CH4 to perhaps C10H22, saturated hydrocarbon. See what happened to that little bump? Got bigger, higher in percentage as I went up in carbon. If I go to C20, H now 42, that peak keeps getting taller. C40, H82. Almost half the height of the peak at this point. And if I go to C50, H102, it is just a little bit more than 55%, 56% at this point. Let me knock it up to C100. And this will be now 202. That peak is now almost equal in intensity to the molecular ion peak. And yet I have all these other peaks that are starting to crop up. So what are all of these peaks that are happening? And why does this peak to the right of my molecular ion peak continue to increase as I go up in the number of carbons that are in my formula? Okay. So what's going on there, which is really cool, is that that is showing me the relative abundance of the molecular ion peak with a carbon-13 isotope in it. So when we look at isotopes, carbon-12 is 98. Let's get the exact percentages. I know it's 1.1, so that means that it's 98.9. Periodic table, carbon isotopes, 98.9.
Wait a minute, are you drawing?
Oh, I was, but it didn't kick in, did it?
Yeah, it says you need to connect to Wi-Fi and do screen mirroring. It's a weird little screen.
It's lying. It's just being a butt there. Okay, better?
Yeah.
Awesome, thank you. C12 is 98.9% of all carbons. C13 is 1.1%. And C14 is essentially 0%. It's so small that we don't count C14. Okay, so because if we look at how much each one of these things weighs in terms of atomic mass units, that the carbon weighs 12 AMUs, the C13 weighs 13 AMUs, C14 weighs 14 AMUs. This is our mass number, which is the sum of the protons plus the neutrons. And because a proton weighs approximately the same amount as a neutron, 1 AMU, then that's how much the element itself weighs. So when we go and we look at CH4, what we're seeing is that these are almost all C12s, and that this equals 12 plus 4, 16 AMUs. Or we could say that the charge to mass ratio that we would see for this, for the molecular ion peak, would be 16. If I were to have a C13 in that, and this were to be an isotopically labeled molecule of methane, then its MZ ratio is going to be 17, one mass unit higher than the C12. And so what we see when we do mass spec is we get a peak, which is here at 16, where this is the molecular ion peak. And that molecular ion peak, we're getting the charge to mass ratio. It's telling me what it is. And then one unit over here at 17, I get a little tiny peak. And that little tiny peak is the molecular ion that contains one C13. And the height, relative height distribution of this, is that whatever height this is here, in terms of my relative abundance, let's say that this is X relative abundance, then this peak that is here is going to equal 1.1% of X. Because C13 is 1.1% of all carbons. So it's not just 1.1% of X though, it is 1.1% of the number of carbons in X. So I should really change this, that it's not 1.1% of X, but it is 1.1% of, mathematically, I'm not exactly sure how I want to describe it, but let's say 1.1% of the number of carbons in X. In other words, the ratio of these two are mathematically related together, such that as I increase the number of carbons in my formula and I go to something that is like C50, H102, and these are all C12s, and I look at this and say, all right, this is my mass, which I was not prepared. I've just calculated it out. 50 times 12 plus 102 is 702. So this would be 702. Then the molecular ion peak that I see over here that is at 703 is the molecular ion peak that contains just one C13 atom. And that height, that relative abundance that is coming out here, is related to the relative abundance of X by that 1.1% times the number of carbons times the relative abundance of X. So basically what we see here is we see 1.1% times C50 times X, essentially, in order to figure out what the height of that peak is. So the height of this peak is proportional to the number of carbons that are in my formula. That's essentially what I'm trying to say. So the height of that C13 is proportional to both the number of carbons in the formula and the relative abundance of the molecular ion peak, which means that I can calculate the number of carbons that are in a formula if I know the relative abundance of the molecular ion peak and the relative abundance of the C13 peak. I can back calculate how many carbons are in the formula. Using the relative abundance of the molecular ion and the relative abundance of the molecular ion with 1C13. We'll label it that way. Okay, and so the way that we do that, the calculation that we typically do is we take the relative abundance of the C13 peak. Of the molecular ion with a C13 in it. You divide that by the relative abundance of the molecular ion peak. And then what we do is we multiply that by 100. And then that whole thing, we take that whole thing and divide that by 1.1. And this equals the number of carbons in the formula. And so we can use a combination of tools to be able to figure out what the correct molecular formula is now, because we can do this. We can take and we can find the molecular ion peak. Let's say identify molecular ion. Once you identify the molecular ion peak, you can use the rule of 13 to find possible formulas. And then you can use the C13. Let's say the molecular ion C13 to find the number of carbons and between these two will punch out the molecular formula. Because once you have the possible formulas, remember that the way that we get to the possible formulas is by taking away carbons and hydrogens and adding in oxygens, nitrogens, chlorines, other things. That each one of those formulas has a different number of carbons in it. Figure out the right number of carbons, you figure out the correct molecular formula. Does that make sense?
What are the other little peaks that started to form then?
Those are the possibilities of having two C13s or three C13s or four C13s. The possibility of having that many C13s in the molecule goes up with the number of carbons in the molecule. So essentially by the time we get to 100 carbons in a molecule, you essentially have 100% possibility of finding one C13. And therefore, they become equivalent in their intensities. But you also then have a 50% probability of finding two C13s. And you have a quarter possibility of finding three C13s. And so their intensities follow suit. Okay, Keegan, would possible deuterium throw off the proportion slightly? Oh, dude, always with the good questions. Yes, however, deuterium is so small in terms of its percent that unless it's an enriched deuterium molecule, it's not a problem. We don't generally see that throwing it off very much. What is interesting, though, is just in the way that I'm saying that we can find the number of carbons, we can also find the number of oxygens if you know where to look to find the oxygen, because the most abundant isotope of oxygen is oxygen 16. The second most abundant is oxygen 18. And so if you go 2 units up from the molecular oxygen, the molecular ion peak, and you use the oxygen 18 isotope, you can do the same exact thing if you know the percentages of oxygen 18 to 16, you can back calculate the number of oxygens in the molecule, which is also super cool. However, that number is oftentimes so tiny as to be very difficult to use in the calculation. So oftentimes trying to use the oxygen isotope peak isn't very helpful just because the data isn't available on the spectrum itself. So let's show an example of this. Let's go grab, I hesitate a little bit to do this because I don't have, I don't have good spectrum to pull from in order to show this, but let's go see what we can find.
Hey, Jason.
Yes.
I'm like 90% sure you already said it, but I'm trying to wrap my head around, why are we using the less abundant isotope?
The less abundant isotope is helpful because in nature, it occurs in a specific ratio with the more abundant. So we're not using the less abundant on its own. We're using the less abundant in ratio to the more abundant. We're using both numbers simultaneously because that number, we know that all C13s are 1.1% of all C12s. And because in nature, they are locked in that 1.1%, that means that we can use that percentage and the relative abundances of these two peaks to back calculate how many number of carbons there are in the molecule overall. I think it'll be more clear with an example. I don't know if my words made that more clear or not.
That helped for sure, but yes, examples usually help more.
Examples are better. Yes, I agree. I concur. Let's choose something for which they're giving us the percentages. Here's one. I'll click on it. Let's bring this in. So it's always nice when they give us the percentages of both the C13 and the molecular ion peak at the same time. And this will help us to demonstrate. Okay, so in this structure, let's first just sort of identify some different components of what's going on in the spectrum. Because black and red are already taken in here, I'm going to do my annotations in blue. I think that'll make it a little bit easier to read. This peak here is the molecular ion peak. The molecular ion peak is 114. And its relative percent abundance is 14.6%. The molecular ion peak that has one C13 in it is at 115, and its relative abundance is 1.2%. Other things that are in this spectrum, besides the molecular ion peak and this guy out here, which has our C13 on it, is 43. This peak is the base peak. Base peak being the peak that comes out at 100% is the base peak. This is relative abundance. So what they do is they set that to 100 for the tallest peak, and then everything else is gauged accordingly. And then all of these other things that are going on in here, these are all fragments. Looking at the way that the molecule is fragmenting. Okay. And so what we can do, though, is we can use the molecular ion peak to first calculate some formulas that may be possible formulas. So what we'll do is we'll use the rule of 13. We'll take 114 and we'll divide it by 13 to figure out how many times that CH group is represented within this formula. We'll find that, we'll do it this way. We'll find that 114 divided by 13 equals 8. And change, we take 8 and multiply it by 13 to see what that component is. That's 104. Take it away. That gives you 10 more units. So my possible formula here is C8H8+10. And that's going to equal my C8H18. That's one possible formula. Now, as we did before, in order to figure out additional formulas, I'll look back at the spectrum and I'll say, are there any chlorines or bromines? And I don't see any doubling up of any peaks that are out here. So no, there's no chlorines, there's no bromines in this. It's an even mass. For those people who are in the morning lab, even mass means that it does not contain nitrogen. So I'm going to ignore nitrogen. I'll talk about that in a minute. We'll cover that specifically. But what I'll do is I'll look at the possibility that this may have one or more oxygens in it. And so an oxygen weighs 16. That is a carbon and 4 hydrogens. I'll take that away. And I'll add in an oxygen in its place. So that gives me C7H14O is a possible formula. I could do that repeatedly to add in maybe as many as 3 oxygens. We have many molecules that we say that have 3, some that have 4. So how many times you do this is a matter of how many carbons do I have and how many can I add before I run out of space. So this is C6, now H10O2. Maybe one more time, just to give me some possibilities. CH4 plus oxygen would take me to C5H6O3. And I'll call it quits there. Okay, so I have 4 formulas that all add up to 114, that represent 114. Which formula is the correct one? Let's go use these isotopes up here in the molecular ion peaks and their relative abundances to sort that out. So what I said that I would do is use the C13 isotope. We take the C13 molecular ion peak relative abundance. We divide it by the relative abundance of the molecular isotope peak. We multiply that by 100. And then we take that quantity and we divide that quantity by 1.1. The 1.1, this number, is the relative abundance of C13 to C12, the natural relative abundance. So what I'm basically doing is I'm seeing what is the ratio of C13 to molecular ion in my compound, turn that into a percentage, and then divide that by the C13, C12 natural percentage, and that will tell me how many carbons are actually in my molecule. So that is going to be 1.2 divided by 14.6. We multiply that by 100. And we take that and we divide that by 1.1. And oftentimes we will get a number that is close to a round number and we just round it off. And hopefully we get close. 1.2 divided by 14.6 times 100. Divide that by 1.1. And we get a nice number that's like 7.4. That's not as nice as I want, or 7.5. Usually, this number comes out a lot closer to a whole number. 7.2 would be much more favorable, or 7.8 would be much more favorable. 7.5 is kind of sucky. And how do we round this off? But let's just use our particular rounding rules that we're rounding to one sig fig and four. So we'll round down and we'll say that this is going to be approximately 7 in rounding down. And because that comes out to 7, this would be my correct assumed formula then, that the C7H14O would be the correct molecular formula. Does that make sense in terms of how I went through that? So most of the time what I do is when I give you the C13 isotope peak, I usually make sure that the percentages are working out right. And if I need to doctor it just a little bit to make it a little bit cleaner, I don't leave it so ambiguous as coming out of 7.5. It's a little bit unfortunate in that example, but we grabbed a random example and that's the way it worked out. All right, so that's how I would find the molecular formula. And once I've got the molecular formula, then I can move forward from that, which is really, really nice. And that illustrates how to use the C13 isotope peak. Okay, the other thing that I wanted to do today is cover these fragmentations a little bit more. So let me go back into fragmentations. The fragmentations can be useful in terms of figuring out subunits and functional groups. And there's two main types of fragmentations that we look for that can be helpful. There are many, many more, I should say, but two main types that we follow. These two main types are alpha cleavage. And within alpha, there are homolytic and heterolytic. And then there's something that we follow that is called the McLafferty, which is a really common type of cleavage as well. And so these are our two main types. Other cleavages we leave to be more obscure and we can look them up and we don't follow them as much as we follow these, but we like to be able to do these. So the alpha cleavage, when we're looking at an alpha cleavage is the same across all functional groups. Basically what it is that if we look at a free radical and we have a carbon or some atom, let's not leave it as a carbon. Let's leave it as element Y, which is bound to a carbon. And we could say bound to different things here. And this is the free radical. This carbon, this is the alpha carbon. And that means that if that's the alpha carbon, then any bond which comes off of that carbon is an alpha bond. So these bonds here are alpha bonds. And when we look at alpha cleavage, we're looking at the cleavage of an alpha bond. The reason that we see the cleavage of the alpha bond in this way is, let's take a look at cleaving this bond here. If I were to cleave this bond, what I can do is I can take the electron from that bond And I can throw that electron over into a bond here with this bond, with that electron. Oh, I forgot to show where the other one goes. The other electron goes to this carbon. And the fragmentation process produces a double bond with the alpha carbon and produces a carbon free radical as it comes off. And this is why we see alpha cleavages so predominantly, is because they give rise to carbon radicals, which are slightly more stable radicals. And oftentimes, because this is not just a radical, it's a radical cation, the charge persists on the Y atom as a formal charge, and we get the charge species that comes out of that. And we can see this across all functional groups. So we can look at it and we can see how we can see this in oxygens and nitrogens, alcohols, amines, ethers, aldehydes, ketones, even alkenes. We can go through and we can show examples of how we can see an alpha cleavage in this way. So let me just show you a couple of examples that we can take an alcohol that has lost an electron and is a radical cation. And if we follow the alpha carbon, and then we look at each of these as being alpha bonds that come off that alpha carbon, then what I can do is I can have the fragmentation of any one of these three, all three, which will be identical. One electron will go to that carbon. One electron will come out of this bond and go into forming the double bond with the oxygen. And as it fragments, I get a CH3 group that is a radical, and I get the oxygen. I'm going to leave it at a poor bond angle here. Well, I'll fix it a little bit. That is positively charged. This piece up here represents the loss. This represents the new ion, which is observable. Another word that we would say this is the fragment that is the observable fragment. And this would have a mass to charge ratio that would be equal to C3H7O. So they're showing an oxygen. When we have an alkene, the alkene would have a radical cation. Let's do it this way. I'll show you the alkene. And then from the alkene, what I'll do is I'll create the radical cation so we understand kind of where things are coming from. So this was our alcohol. This is our alkene example. We'll lose an electron. We go to a molecular species now that has the radical. Yeah, I'll leave the radical here. Radical and the cation. Our alpha is this guy, and the alpha bond is that bond. So we split that bond. We take one electron and throw it in with the radical. The other electron goes to the methyl group. And the alpha cleavage results in a resonance stabilized allylic cation, and in this case, a methyl radical. So this would be our loss, and this would be our fragment that would have an MZ ratio that was equal to C3H2345. If I'm reading that correctly. And that would be my fragment. With carbonyls, when we look at a carbonyl, The fragmentation process is the same. We have the radical cation, we have the alpha carbon, and the alpha bond, of which there are multiple alpha bonds. But we're going to look at the right-hand side one first. So what I would do is I would break it, take the electron, push it in, create the double bond. This one goes out onto the terminal carbon. That gives me a triple bond now, and I'm careful about my bond angle because it's sp hybridized. And the other component becomes the loss of the free radical. It is neutral. And this has an MZ ratio equal to CH3O plus. That would be that guy. Now, each of these, when we write them, we have a standard notation in the way that we write these. So the standard notation, if I take my alcohol example and copy it, the standard notation for fragmentation takes the molecule and draws the molecule . We give its mass to charge ratio. For this one, it is C4H3691010O. That would be equal to 48 plus 10, 58 plus 16, 74. And then what we do is we show the fragmentation as a line which cleaves the alpha bond. And then we show a line down or across which shows the observable fragment. This piece that is outside of the box, this is the loss. And then what we do is we calculate that. That is equal to 36 plus 7 plus 16. It's equal to 59. We put that 59 number inside this box to illustrate that this thing here, which represents this charged species, will have a mass of 59 for its observable mass. For the carbonyls, when we do the carbonyls, we do the same sort of thing. We can take this carbonyl one as an example. And show the molecule itself show the cleavage that happens through the alpha bond and then the observable portion that would be charged. This is going to be the piece that is going to be 12 plus 3 plus 16, 31. This is going to be a mass of 31 for that piece. And the overall molecule would have an MZ ratio, which is equal to C5H10O, So that's going to be 60, 70, 86. I don't even need the calculator. You start getting good at doing these just in your head as you're just calculating them out. In terms of showing the cleavages. All right, is this clear so far? Everything's going okay? I know this is a little bit dry in this part. We're not doing so much application. We're just still talking about notation and how do we keep track of everything. Okay.
So Jason, we would see a peak. Oh, sorry.
No, you go, Drew.
We would see a peak at 31 and 86 for this molecule we're just looking at, right?
What we would see, hopefully, is we would hopefully see an 86 peak that would be out here that would be the molecular ion peak. And then hopefully we would see a 31 somewhere down here. And we would see a whole lot of other things. But the question is, do we see the 31? And there's another cleavage that I could have that is here that is the second alpha cleavage that could go the opposite direction, where I would have the loss of 15. And so I would have 86 minus 15. 71, this would be the 71 mass for that piece of molecule. And I would expect that I might also get a 71 out here as being the other alpha fragment. Now, do I see the 31 and the 71? Hopefully, but not all the time. The fragmentation process is dependent upon the technique that is used to ionize, the temperature of the sample, the flight time through the detector, how long it spins in the detector. Different detectors have different configurations. Some of the detectors are long and what are called a quadrupole, where they have four magnets and they work on what's called time of flight. There, because the detector is so long, they spend more time in the detector. Sometimes you see more fragmentations. Some detectors are the curved beam that I was showing you before. There, it's not time of flight, but how curved the molecule actually, the path that it follows. So there's a lot of factors that determine whether a molecule fragments or not. And then also the stability of the fragment itself. How stable is the fragment? If the fragment isn't that stable, regardless of the fact that I can draw it or not, I may not see them. So I may see them with different relative intensities. One more piece yet, which is we were looking at alpha fragments. What we did up here, this was all alpha homolytic. We need to also consider heterolytic. So let me demonstrate heterolytic, particularly with carbonyls. Most of the time, the heterolytics are with carbonyls, not with other things. So this will be heterolytic alpha cleavage. Usually with carbonyls. Of which there are a lot of different types of carbonyl compounds. Okay, so the heterolytic cleavage, the way it works, let's take that same molecule that I was just using. So this is the molecule that we used above here. And let's say that we have the radical cation that we're starting from. We can look at these with radical resonance, and we can show the radical resonance of this compound. The resonance of this compound would take this double bond, the carbonyl, and break it, taking one electron and giving it to the oxygen, and the other electron and giving it to the carbon. So this is actually a resonance contributor, not a fragmentation yet. The oxygen is still positively charged. It has a formal positive charge on the oxygen. And I lost my radical, which is on the carbon now, at the base of that carbon. The alpha bonds are still as discussed. These two are the alpha bonds. But now the way that the alpha bond cleaves is unique in that both electrons go towards the more electronegative element to make a double bond. And notice that I changed my arrow type. I changed from a fishhook arrow to a full arrow. And I did that because I'm moving both electrons into the same direction. That results in a fragmentation that gives me now the double bond to the oxygen, which has two lone pairs, that bond and the free radical on the carbon. And it also gives me now the propyl group with the primary free radical because I stripped the two electrons from that carbon. This is the heterolytic alpha cleavage. And it fundamentally gives me different things. The part with the oxygen now is the loss. And this part has a formula which is C3H3567+. And so it has an MZ ratio, which is equal to 36 plus 7, 43, is what that comes out to be. And I could do that on the other side. But notice what that did is I fragmented this bond here. I fragmented the bond to the right-hand side. And that means that when I draw the carbonyl compound and I look at how the carbonyl compound can fragment, it can fragment in two ways. It can fragment in this way, where this was the homolytic and gave me the fragment that looked like that. Or it can fragment this way, which is heterolytic, which gave me the fragment that looked like that. So this was my 31 fragmentation. This is my 43 fragmentation. Both alpha, just different types of alphas. And on the other side of the carbonyl, it can do the same thing. So let me change colors. Usually we do it all in the same color, but let me change colors and show that on this bond, I can fragment this way and this way. This would be my homolytic and would give me the oxygen with the alkyl portion. This gives me the triple bonded oxygen with the positive charge and the three additional carbons. That was the 71, yes. This one was 71. And the other piece that's over here, this is going to be the heterolytic. This is going to give me just the CH3 portion. And that's going to be 15. Which means that when I look at the spectrum of this molecule, I expect that hopefully I see a peak out here. This is my 86. This would be the molecular ion peak. And then I've got 71, 43, 31, and 15. And these are all possible fragmentations. They may not all show up. One or more of these are likely to show up, but they may not all show up. But it gives me a way of mapping it out, and it gives me a way of knowing what the possibilities are for analyzing a compound and showing what the fragmentations might look like.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah.
Does heterolytic cleavage only exist when there is an oxygen, a halogen, or something other than like a hydrocarbon chain within a molecule?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. Because it kind of seemed like it's heterolytic if we cleave it, not including that group, and it's homolytic if we cleave it and the fragmented group includes that atom.
Right. So the homolytic, when you get the homolytic, you're splitting a bond equally and you're sending one electron each direction. Unless you have an oxygen, a nitrogen, or some type of heteroatom that can make an additional bond or accept electrons, we don't generally see the heterolytic type of cleavage. We only see the homolytic. So it's really on these carbonyls that we start to see these heterolytic types of cleavages, alpha cleavages. But carbonyls are so many different types of compounds. I mean, when you look at the number of, you've got ketones, you've got aldehydes, you've got carboxylic acid, you've got esters, amides, acid chlorides, we could keep going, lactones, lactams. So there's many different types of carbonyl compounds that we can see that undergo these types of cleavages. And they're by far more prominent than the alcohols and the amines because, you know, alcohols and amines, those are one functional group. And those functional groups don't appear in other types of functional groups, but carbonyls appear in many different types of functional groups. So we see all of these functional groups will undergo this type of cleavage. Okay, and because these types of cleavages are important too, this takes me to the McLafferty really quickly. Now, McLafferty is just really common with carbonyl compounds of a certain size, which is why we tend to focus on it a little bit. It's a common pattern with carbonyl compounds. And the way that this one looks like is that if we have a carbonyl compound that has sort of a longer chain on it, then what happens is when we get the molecular ion peak, the molecule, as it's going through all of its vibrational frequencies, can arrange itself into a pattern where if we number this out and we look at the oxygen and we say, we start numbering at the oxygen 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, this is number 5. I'm going to take the hydrogen that is here off of 5, that goes to 6, it goes like that, so here's number 6. And I almost hesitate to draw number 6 in like this, but it is the hydrogen on carbon number 5 or atom number 5. Starting from oxygen is 1. The free radical that is here does a rearrangement by abstracting the proton almost like an acid base. So it's going to take the proton. The proton bond is cleaved. The electrons that are in that bond go to make a double bond between number 4 and number 5. The bond between 3 and 4 breaks, and the electrons swing in that way and swing out onto number 3, such that as this whole thing breaks apart and degrades, it's a concerted rearrangement and fragmentation. What it gives is a radical, which is stabilized by the carbonyl. So this is a alpha radical stabilized by the carbonyl. And it gives a neutral molecule, and that neutral molecule that comes off and the stability of the resonance that we're seeing with the carbonyl in that free radical is what makes this a very prominent type of concerted reaction. So if we look at this and we say that this molecular ion has an MZ ratio, and we'll calculate out its formula, it's C1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, we're C8. That means that we're H16O, and that is going to be 8 times 12 plus 16 plus 16 plus 32. I should have just done that way, 128. So this was 128 for that molecular ion. This guy, the MZ ratio is going to be based on C3H. There are only 2 hydrogens on this carbon, 3 on this carbon, so that's 5, that's number 6. Oh, and that thing is going to be 36 plus 6 plus 16, 58. And this piece over here is the loss. And that's the McLafferty. So the McLafferty can happen, and these don't have to all be carbons. Elements number 3, element number 4 doesn't have to be a carbon. They can be nitrogens or other oxygens. It just has to be a hydrogen attached to the 5th carbon counting from the oxygen. And that can get you the McLafferty. All right, I am looking at the next thing that I want to go into and realizing that I don't have time to do that. I've got 10 minutes. So let's put to use what you've already done rather than me giving you something new. Let's do this. Let's give you a concept test. Let me draw a molecule. Let's go with an ester. Let's say that it's this ester. And I want to know the MZ ratio for this molecule. I want to know what I expect to see in terms of that. I also want to know expected alpha cleavages. There are 4. two which are homolytic, and two which are heterolytic. And I want to know the McLafferty. I want to know what to expect for those cleavages out of this molecule. Anybody figure out what that MZ ratio is supposed to be first off for the main molecule, what its formula is? 130, Drew? Okay, you guys keep working on the other things. I'll check that 130. Sounds good to me, but let's see what we've got. I agree. Okay, now with the alpha cleavages, there's different ways in which we can get to the alpha cleavages. I recommend drawing out the mechanisms because I'm going to ask you for the mechanisms. So it's a good thing to sit down and draw out the homolytic alphas. So we take the molecule and we're looking at both sides of the molecule. So we choose one side and then the other. We take the free radical, we push an electron in, we break the bond that we're interested in, take one electron from that, and one electron back to the carbon. This gives us our fragmentation that is going to be the free radical on the ethyl plus I end up with a positively charged carbonyl with an oxygen on it. And then this guy has the remainder of the carbons, which are 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So that would be the piece that I would get there. This piece is my loss. This is going to have an MZ ratio, which is going to be equal to C5H. I've got 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, H9O2. And I would calculate that as 60 plus 9 plus 32. 101. And then we do the other side. We start back over. We break the other bond this time. Take the electrons, throw them in, give one to the oxygen. This time, the oxygen triple bond is going to go to the ethyl group. And the oxygen free radical that comes off will be my loss. And so this is going to be an MZ ratio, which is going to be 1, 2, 3, C3, H5O. So that's going to be 36 plus 5 plus 16, 57.
So Jason, that one would still work even though the loss violates the octet for the oxygen?
Yeah, you know how I said, Drew, that sometimes these fragments, you're going to see them and sometimes you're not. This is a fragment that I would not expect to see a lot of, because the oxygen free radical that's getting kicked out is not going to be a very stable free radical.
But we can still draw it and assume it might be there.
That's right.
Okay, gotcha.
It's worth drawing and looking for, even though it may not show up.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, and now that we've drawn those two, everybody good with those two? Now let's do the two heterolytic. So now we've got our two heterolytics. Okay, here what we do is we take the resonance contributor. And from the resonance contributor, and you can draw the resonance contributor first if you want, or I mean, you could draw the original molecular ion and then convert it into the resonance contributor. Or if you can just see the resonance contributor, you can just draw it from there. Here, what we do is we start on one side, strip the electrons, throw them in, and draw what we get from that. This is going to give us the ethyl cation, a primary carbocation, which may not be all that stable. May not expect to see this one. That's okay, we draw it anyway. This becomes our loss, and this becomes C2H5 plus with an MZ ratio, which is equal to 26 plus 5, 31. Notice how I keep going to grab for the calculator and realizing that I can do this in my head. Spark the calculator back. And then we do the other side. So we go back to the same picture. This one may be really bad, because what we're going to do here is we're going to break the alpha bond and take both electrons and throw them into this bond. We're really stripping this oxygen now. So this one we would really not expect to see, but still we can draw it. Plus this guy, which now has two lone pairs for the oxygen, but is positively charged. So this is going to have a formula, which is going to be C4H3567891. With a positive charge. And an MZ ratio, which is equal to 48 plus 9 plus 16, 73. One last thing to go. McLafferty, and then we can kind of put them all together. And McLafferty's tend to be very common. If a molecule can get the right arrangement, the McLafferty almost always happens. So they're a pretty good thing to look for. Now on the McLafferty, what we do is we take and we arrange this thing in a six-membered ring conformation, where we pull the hydrogen and we're counting out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The sixth element is the hydrogen itself. And notice that what it's making is it's making a six-membered ring system here. Remember how common six-membered ring systems are in organic chemistry. Six-membered ring systems rule organic chemistry because the bond angles are of 109.5. There is very little ring strain. And these things happen so commonly. There are so many different reactions that occur in six-membered ring conformations. They are just super cool and super common. And that's where this McLafferty comes from. So counting our carbons, making sure we've got the right number. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. And I do, and I've set it up in the six-membered ring conformation. Now, the way that this one works is the electron here combines with the electron here from the hydrogen. This electron goes that way, which combines with that one, and this one falls back onto atom number 3, which is the oxygen. So I am breaking the hydrogen bond, and I am breaking the 3-4 bond. And then I just draw what my arrows show me. that is a carbonyl bound to a hydrogen, one lone pair, positive charge, ethyl group, oxygen with a free radical. That's going to be resonance stabilized by the other oxygen. So this is pretty common. I get the double bond between 4 and 5 and what is ever left coming off of 4 and 5. So I'm looking at atom 4, atom 5, 6, 7, 6, 7, and 1, 2, and 3 are shown there. This piece is the loss. This piece has a formula, which is C3H5 6O2, and a mass to charge ratio, which is going to be 36 plus 16 plus 32, 84. Drop the mic. Not too bad. So we just went through an entire molecule and just showed how we could actually figure out all the fragmentations in that molecule. Pretty good stuff. We could also take this and write this out so that we could take all the data that we just found if we wanted to, and we could write out the different cleavages. And then the McLafferty is not an easy thing to draw, so I would just write the McLafferty separately. But you know, we've got 73 for this guy, 31 for this guy, 57 and 101, 101 and 57, and a McLafferty that equals 84. And there it's all put together. Which makes it kind of nice to be able to see. It's just a more concise way of putting all that information together to know what you're looking for. Okay, on Tuesday, I will show you common fragmentation patterns for all the different functional groups. And we'll go through and we'll do a bunch of examples of how do we take the data and process the data and figure out what the right answer is. And that's what we'll do on Tuesday. All right. Thanks for a good lecture. I'll take any questions.
Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome, Drew. You're welcome, Kelly.
I've got a quick question.
Yeah, JC.
So for test corrections, how would you like those to be done?
JC, of course, everyone is welcome to do the test corrections. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put a tab into the Canvas shell. I'll put it on the exam module. I'll open it up for test corrections. Test corrections, what I usually ask you to do is to rework the problems that you got wrong. You don't need to reconnect it to the exam because within Canvas, I already have your exam. So I can look back and I can see what you did wrong there. Usually what I do is I have people do the corrections on a separate sheet of paper and then attach it to the exam and turn it both back into me so that I can sort of review what you did and what the correction is. But in this case, I would say just recorrect problems that you got wrong, explaining sort of the misconception and what the correct answer is. If you got over a 90, the test corrections aren't going to do you a whole bunch of good because I do it sort of on a sliding scale. So if somebody got something that was in the 50s, usually I try to get them up into a passing grade in terms of the number of points that they lost. I have a lot more room to give them back, and they're also going to be doing a whole lot more work. So somebody who got something in the 50s, I usually try to get them up into the low to mid 70s. Somebody who got something that was in the 70s, I might try to bump them into the 80s. Somebody who got something in the 80s, I would try to bump them into the 90s. Usually it bumps you up sort of one grade. So for an A, somebody who had a high A, I certainly think that there is value in reviewing what you missed to rectify the misconceptions that happened, but it may not affect your grade a whole lot because you're already getting an A. You're in good position, but anybody is welcome to, and I will take it and I will throw points at anybody who does it. But you got to wait for me to put that module up there.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay.
Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome, guys. All right, take care, everyone.